Today's Washing Tech episode is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at washingtech.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And also Warby Parker. Get a free 5-day home try-on at warbyparkertrial.com/joe. 5 pairs, 5 days, and the try-on is 100% free. That's warbyparkertrial.com/joe.
Race is a part of our society. Race, racial discrimination, racism, it is a part of our society. And it appears in the marketplace.
Welcome to the Washing Tech Tech Policy Podcast. We deliver the latest tech policy news and brightest tech policy experts to you. Wherever you are, so you can stay productive, relevant, and informed in less time. From Washington, D.C., it's the Washing Tech Tech Policy Podcast with Joe Miller.
One of the Google walkout organizers leaves the company. Maine signs a robust privacy bill. And Alfred Mathewson is my guest today. Hey, everybody. Claire Stapleton, one of the organizers of last year's global walkout at Google following revelations that the company allegedly hid sexual harassment allegations against Android developer Andy Rubin, has left the company, saying she was retaliated against. She wrote in an internal document later posted on Medium by Google walkout for Real Change, quote, "These past few months have been unbearably stressful and confusing, but they've been eye-opening too. The more I spoke up about what I was experiencing, the more I heard, and the more I understood how universal these issues are," end quote. Stapleton said she's leaving the company because she's having a baby, and Google has continued to refute the allegations. The state of Maine's Governor Janet Mills signed a new privacy bill into law last week, requiring carriers to get consumers' permission before selling their data to third parties. It specifically prohibits ISPs from retaliating against consumers for refusing to allow their data to be sold. YouTube shifted gears and revoked the ads of far-right commentator Steven Crowder over Crowder's use of homophobic language. The company backtracked following outcry over its initial defense of Crowder, but the ban isn't permanent. Crowder simply must remove the offensive content, including the homophobic t-shirts he was selling in his online store. The FCC allowed carriers last week to ban even more robocalls, allowing them to stop calls on behalf of subscribers. The order had bipartisan support, but Democrat Jessica Rosenworcel said it opens the door for carriers to charge for the services since the order doesn't contain any language to prevent that from happening. Pew reports that rural communities lag the rest of the country when it comes to tech adoption. At 63%, rural households are 10 points lower than the rest of the country in tech adoption. Smartphone penetration at 67% is also 10 points lower. Tablet penetration and the number of households with desktop computers also lags. Finally, it looks like you're going to have an alternative to TurboTax. The tax preparation service is facing some competition from the IRS itself. Congress has killed a provision of the Taxpayer First Act that would have prevented the IRS from creating its own free online tax filing service. Events. Today, Tuesday, June 11th, NCTA and the Rural Broadband Caucus are having an event called Trailblazing a Path for Rural Broadband. That's 11:30 to 1 p.m. at NCTA, located at 25 Massachusetts Ave. Uber is having its Elevate Summit also at the Reagan International Center over there by the old post office. That's happening today and tomorrow. The Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood and Color of Change is having a digital privacy briefing in Rayburn 2322. That's from 3:30 to 5 p.m. today. The Entertainment Software Association today through Wednesday is having its ES3 conference at the L.A. Convention Center. So if you're going to be in L.A., check that out. House Judiciary Committee is having a hearing on online platforms and market power. Part one, the free and diverse press. It's in Rayburn 2141 at 2 p.m. Turning to tomorrow, Wednesday, 6/12, the Federal Communications Commission is having a tribal workshop out at Riverwind Casino in Oklahoma. And that's Wednesday and Thursday. And you can find links to all of these stories in the show notes and also in our Twitter feed. And our handle is at Washing Tech. Stay with us. Audible, which has access to hundreds of thousands of audiobooks, is offering a free 30-day trial. You can access it wherever you are. How about Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight? You can download Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom free by trying audible.com. Sign up for your free audiobook and 30-day trial today at washingtech.com/book.
Washing Tech, the inclusive voice of tech policy. Because America won't stand still for the same old insiders. Washing Tech, moving the needle.
I guess today is Alfred Mathewson, former Emeritus Professor of Law, and Henry Wyhoffen Chair of Law at the University of New Mexico School of Law. He joined UNM law faculty in 1983 after working as a corporate securities and banking lawyer in Denver. He was named the director of the Africana Studies Program in 2013 after having served as acting or interim director since 2009. From 97 to 02, he was Associate Dean of Academics at UNM. In that position, he oversaw the curriculum, clinical law program, faculty appointments, the faculty promotion and tenure process, library, faculty development, and related issues. Professor Mathewson served as co-dean of the law school from 2015 to 2018. Please welcome Alfred Mathewson. Professor Mathewson, it's good to have you on.
Glad to be here.
So there's a lot of discussion about antitrust law these days, particularly in tech, with increased oversight of big tech companies looming, but also with T-Mobile's proposed merger with Sprint. You know, we had Harold Feld on the show recently discussing the need for legislation to address the challenges the internet poses to democracy as opposed to regulation with existing law. But today we're looking specifically at working within the existing framework. So let's start with a thumbnail sketch of how antitrust law works and what regulators and courts traditionally consider when they review mergers and acquisitions and break up monopolies. What are some of the key things your students who are learning about antitrust for the first time need to know, I guess, to pass the final?
There are three major antitrust laws at the federal level in the U.S. There's the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act, and the Clayton Antitrust Act. It's interesting, antitrust is a term that's really unique to the U.S. Outside the United States, it's called competition law because we're talking about laws regulating the marketplace, regulating the flow of goods and service and production in the marketplace. And it, but it came to be called antitrust in the United States because of the big trusts that had arisen in the 19th century. Essentially, states limited the ability of corporations incorporating those states to operate outside their borders. And so the shareholders, the big companies and families actually formed trusts to own multiple corporations, and they became big and they amassed capital. So 1890, the Sherman Act is the Sherman Antitrust Act as opposed to the Sherman Competition Law. The Sherman Act is the one that the big one that students at the very beginning learned, the two sections, big sections, so Section 1 and Section 2. Section 1 regulates unreasonable restraints of trade in commerce, and it requires agreement, a conspiracy to restrain trade. And then Section 2 is the anti-monopoly provision, and it can regulate, apply to a single company. The Clayton Act actually adds treble damages to these, so there are private causes of action that are involved as well. But they're also criminal, so they can be, you can go to jail for violating these laws. The Federal Trade Commission Act regulates unfair methods of competition, and the FTC is the regulatory agency that has the enforcement powers. Any violation of Section 1 is a violation, also a violation of the Federal Trade Commission Act. It's an unfair method of competition, and the FTC, in essence, gets to regulate them, but as a violation of the FTC Act. And then the Clayton Act, in addition to those treble damages, also bans mergers that substantially lessen competition. And so these are the big three statutes that apply. In the merger context, sort of a lot has happened because companies can combine. They can acquire another company, other companies, and become larger. And when they do so, there will be at least one less firm in the marketplace, because in a merger, one company acquires another, and in essence, they become one firm. And so you're reducing competition that much. But the key is does it substantially lessen competition? And after that's the guidelines that are used, the Department of Justice and the FTC both come into play here. And what they look at under the guidelines is really efficiencies now. Prior, I guess, in the Warren area, prior to the guidelines, the scrutiny of mergers was probably more rigorous. And harder to get approval. But since the guidelines, and that's the focus, there's been a recognition that mergers with increased economies of scale can result in market efficiencies and lower prices for consumers. And so that when you're looking at the mergers that you're looking at in the tech industry now, or any the big mergers that you might see, when the Department of Justice or the FTC looks at them, that's what they're going to apply the guidelines. They're looking at market concentration. They look at the degree of concentration. How big are we getting? But they're also looking at the efficiencies that will be generated by the merger.
And so what are the goals of antitrust, and what are the different schools of thought?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about going back to the Sherman Act, which is the first of the acts, 1890, is a statute written by lawyers. Nowadays, a lot of the analysis is really economic analysis and economic terms with concepts that were not even known in 1890. Mm-hmm. So the focus in 1890 was those trusts. They wanted to sort of break up the amassing, the amalgamation of all this economic power in these large companies. And so there was a view toward protecting small business, fair competition in the marketplace, some sense of also preventing monopolists from extracting wealth transfers from consumers through monopoly prices. A monopolist has the power to charge higher than competitive prices, and to the extent that the consumer pays a higher price than they would in a competitive market, that difference, in essence, is a transfer to the monopolist. So there was an anti-monopoly. We're after that. There's some, again, just in terms of trying to control bigness. And in terms of what we can view as the traditional goals of antitrust. And then another one that's often is sort of allocative efficiency and really focusing on consumer welfare, prices and output, of trying to look at, I would say, consumer welfare, which actually takes us to sort of what has happened. There is something known as the Chicago School of Antitrust Law, which has come to dominate antitrust jurisprudence, and its emphasis is consumer welfare and that allocative efficiency, price and output. And so it's the Chicago School and everybody else, although there may be references at time to the Harvard School and some others, but the distinction being how much of those traditional goals become embraced relative to this allocative efficiency. It's controversial now. There has been a student wrote a note in the Yale Law Journal back in 2017, the Amazon antitrust paradox, and which is sort of, is challenging the consumer welfare standard and advocates going back to the more traditional and focusing on competition, regulating competition and looking at market structure.
A student wrote this?
Yes.
And it was influential?
Yes, and she's now graduated. But this is this note, I think, is you can read about it in the news from time to time as the present antitrust issues are discussed. It's been influential, And it is also by those who support the consumer welfare model have criticized the article as well.
Well, I'll criticize it right now. So now, now I want to get to the Howard School. I know you're not at Howard, but you went to Howard, right? Undergrad, I believe.
I did.
All right. So now let's see, if we had a Howard approach, maybe this would inform it to some extent. How have policymakers traditionally thought about sort of the pro-social goals, if there can be such a thing, for antitrust? And what are the tests that courts use or have used to determine whether they're being met?
Well, I can't really say necessarily what the Howard School does. They do have a well-known antitrust scholar. And so, but I can say from my values as having gone to Howard and thinking about antitrust law and what it was designed to do, I look at it in the world, in a country that is a diverse country, a multicultural country. So when we look at that marketplace, there is a diverse marketplace, and there's also a history as well that goes with that, a history of racial justice, a history of social justice. And I would be looking at antitrust law in those terms, thinking about how those values come into play. But if I would say that in the case law, I don't social policy. Is not so much the focus that when the courts are applying that consumer welfare standard, they aren't necessarily looking at, so what are the social goals and how does the policy come into play? They are applying a standard. Even the rule of reason from a case called the Chicago Board of Trade, and restraints, that restraint is unreasonable. Remember that the Section 1 makes unreasonable restraints of trade illegal. It's an unreasonable restraint if the anti-competitive effects outweigh the pro-competitive effects. So what you find are the courts sort of trying to weigh, is it anti-competitive, is it pro-competitive, and how do you balance those? And that sort of analysis has been more advanced. When they do talk about, I would say the opinions will talk about social policy, but it's in explanations of whether something is anti-competitive or pro-competitive. And occasionally you will see a case like U.S. versus Brown University, which involved something called the overlap group. It was an agreement among Ivy League schools and several elite private schools in the Northeast to share financial information. In essence, what they knew that many students were going to apply to more than one of those schools. And in order to maximize the availability of financial aid, they wouldn't compete with financial aid offers. They tried to give sort of matching offers. And the Department of Justice challenged that agreement as price fixing. It made its way all the way to the Second Circuit. I think all of the schools except MIT settled, and MIT decided to fight it. And the court does uphold the agreement, actually, but it took the social policy that we're trying to maximize financial aid to students who otherwise couldn't afford an education at these schools to consumer choice. It was given more choice, students more choice in terms of the schools that they could attend, and justified it as pro-competitive in that way. But they matched, they sort of took the social policy and matched it with the economic terms in terms of whether it was pro-competitive or anti-competitive.
And Higginbotham, Judge Higginbotham wrote about that. Was he in the dissent on that opinion?
He may have been, and I couldn't recall that, but I know that he was very critical of the opinion. The trial court, because it was found that it was illegal, and it's the Second Circuit. He would not have been in the dissent, because I think Higginbotham was on the Third the Third Circuit, I believe. And it was the second, this was the Second Circuit case.
Right. Like you said, I remember him objecting to it, but I'm trying to remember if he was in the dissent.
I haven't looked at it, but I don't think he was.
Yeah. I have to take a look because I definitely saw it someplace. Yeah. So now turning to racial justice, how should antitrust consider race?
Race is a part of our society. Race, racial discrimination, racism, it is a part of our society. And it appears in the marketplace. And so if you take the concerns that antitrust law has and regulating activity within the marketplace, it doesn't make any difference that there's also race involved there. The antitrust laws can still apply. And so I look at it in terms of we do have anti-discrimination laws, and we also have antitrust laws. And you might think of it as there are these two law rooms. And you go into one room and you get anti-discrimination law. You go into another, you get antitrust law.
Right.
And there are some who have argued that if it's race, that you should only use the anti-discrimination law room, even though they may have disagreements about whether there should be an anti-discrimination law, but that would be the proper room to go into and not the antitrust room. And my view has been that, wait a minute, it is still the marketplace and anti-competitive behavior can be going on and race can be a part of that. I don't know if you remember the movie Barbershop 2. And I was trying to remember the name of the chain. Calvin has his barbershop. It's a longtime barbershop in the community, it's a small business. A big chain opens one across the street. They've got all the nicest things that you can do, and it's fancy. And their intent is to drive Calvin out of business. So. Does Calvin use an anti-discrimination door to challenge what they did? Or does Calvin use antitrust law? And I would think that antitrust law would be the proper one. If for no other reason, anti-discrimination law applies to a very discrete set. It applies to employment and not necessarily to business entities and competition within the marketplace. But even if it were employment law, I think that an employment question, the antitrust laws could still apply. There's an interesting 1951 law review article called Civil, I think it's Antitrust Law and Civil Rights, should I got that, in which the author makes that very point that the antitrust laws can apply to what would otherwise be known as civil rights issues, and in part because he viewed it economic rights as civil rights. And if you think back to the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the very first Civil Rights Act, and its regulation of contracting, the very first civil rights statute applies to economic rights. And so this is Philip Marcus, and I was looking at the title. It is antitrust law and civil rights. And basically he says the right to equal opportunity is protected by the antitrust laws. And that just because some other law may apply doesn't mean that the antitrust laws couldn't apply. And this is 1951, 13 years before the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So the idea that antitrust law could be used to address racial issues of race has been around for a while, even if we have not seen it in the law. There's a more recent article by a Professor Hosea Harvey at Temple looking at the movie industry. And his focus is not on employment, it's on the way in which the big studios divided up the markets for black movies, I would say, with black actors, with producers, how they're shown. And in essence, is arguing that it was inefficient, and it produced these skewed racial outcomes. And antitrust law was more appropriate to address those issues than anti-discrimination law. So this is about the economy. This is about economic activity. And in this country with economic activity, race is present. We get racial disparities. We get just racial impacts and effects. And these are things that the antitrust laws could tackle. And I know that one of the things that's going on now is, you know, the Congress is looking at the big tech companies. There is the issue that Yale Law School student note in terms of advocating a change from the consumer welfare standard. That also has been looked at as to whether Congress should do something about the, or the courts for that matter, should do something about the consumer welfare standard and change it. But the, if Congress is going to now look at antitrust, and I think a big point of her argument is that these big tech companies, they cast a huge footprint, and that their impact goes beyond just price and output, that they have larger impacts on competition and the structure of the market. And one of those being like privacy. And without adequate competition in the marketplace, bad things can happen. And one would be privacy is, to me, one of the things that comes with that bigness is their impact on race. Now, one of the things I learned in law school was a classical economic theory that racial discrimination in employment doesn't occur in competitive markets.
Yeah, right.
Because a competitor would just hire that person. Well, one of the implications of that, if we should find racial discrimination, we should find those racial impacts, then it's not a competitive market. And that, or even if otherwise just looking, is that one of the things that could happen with bigness and concentration, with less competition, you could in fact see more racial discrimination. And I do think that there are things like this that Congress should take a look at the racial impacts of the exercise of market power, monopoly power.
Interesting, because we often think of race as sort of a byproduct of antitrust, but you're saying that even with robust antitrust rules that lead to more competition, that more competition can actually cause or perpetuate racial disparities.
Yeah, what I'm saying is actually more it may go the other way, is that more competition may reduce racial disparities.
Okay, so you're what you're saying is in line with what we've been talking about in terms of antitrust sort of being a panacea to some extent. Or a stronger antitrust being sort of a way to get at race without talking about race directly? Is that what I hear you saying?
Well no, I'm saying you can talk about race directly with antitrust. that racial effects are consequent. One of the things that you see happening in the marketplace with anti-competitive behavior. And so what we don't, and this is one thing about Professor Harvey is saying, is more study needs to be made.
Right. Absolutely.
Of these racial impacts and the extent to which they can be regulated through antitrust law.
Right. Right. Because it is a deeply ingrained problem. I wonder where we would even begin to look at that, or where a study would even begin, or what data we would even seek to collect.
Well, I think Professor Harvey did a good job with the movie industry. It's a very his article is an empirical work, and actually I think from looking at I think his whole idea is trying to use data and empirical work to look at race and social justice, particularly as it applies to economic activity.
Well, Professor Mathewson, a lot to unpack. So thank you so much for your time. Excellent article. We've linked to your article in the show notes. Now let's turn to your icebreaker, your career hack, and your pick for our book this week. Okay, so it's time for this week's icebreaker. If you could instantly become an expert in something, what would it be?
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, really.
That's something I've looked at for a long time. But I'm interested in artificial intelligence, not to program with machines, but the extent to which you can help people learn.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of issues with AI, and I think it's with the horse is already out of the barn. I try to avoid cliches on this show, but it doesn't always happen. What's the first piece of advice you give most of your students when they come to you for career advice?
Find your passion in the law and use it to motivate your study. Once you graduate, take your passion to law and become a really good lawyer.
Tell us a book you're reading these days.
Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David Blight.
I took his Yale course, his Yale online course on the Civil War and Reconstruction. It was fantastic. That he's a brilliant man.
It is a fantastic book.
Well, thanks again, Professor Mathewson, for joining me. Do you have any final ideas you'd like to leave with us before we close? And where can we find you online?
You will not find me online except at the University of New Mexico School of Law. an email, you can reach me at Mathewson with one T at law.unm.edu. And I hope that your listeners take an interest in what we've talked about and they consider that there may be indeed a lot that can be done with antitrust law to deal with racial disparities.
Absolutely. So let's do it. You've been listening to Alfred Mathewson, former dean and professor emeritus at the University of New Mexico School of Law. Professor, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure doing this.
Lots to learn about the role of race in antitrust. The role that race should play in antitrust is something I look forward to learning more about and communicating with you all about as you work and as you pursue your advocacy efforts here in town. That concludes episode 189 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment and head over to Apple Podcasts. Give it a review. It helps others know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care.
Washing Tech.